Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for the dawn of America
of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
Oh my God. No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules. And at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. When it rains, it pours. I'm waiting on Kutch to call in. Our guest tonight is Joshua Kutch Kutchin, my dear friend and buddy and author of a number of books. All right, well, he should be calling in a moment, I guess. So I guess I'll update you because I was gone last week. I didn't do a show, and I feel bad about that. We never do the in-house notes at the end because by the end of the show, I'm usually exhausted and worn out, and I'm just like, forget in-house notes. But since we're waiting on Kutch, I'll do some in-house notes. Yeah, so I didn't do a show last week because I was so tired. I was just burning the candle at both ends, like I said earlier on Facebook. When I was telling people, Kutch just got in here now, so, all right, let's bring him in. You don't care about in-house notes. Josh Kutchin, what's going on, buddy?
Hey, I forgot that you use, you're old school, man. You still like the cell phones.
Yeah, dude, yeah, you know I'm old school. So, yeah, Kutch is he's familiar with the old school ways of Banal, but it's been a while since we had him on the show. Now, because of your phone problems, dude, it's all disjointed. Yeah, I didn't get to do, you know, my fantastic introduction and tell everyone how wonderful you are. So,
yeah, well, that's on me. Besides, everybody knows, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
I was just going to say nobody cares about this interview because tomorrow is the big disclosure day. It's the big DeLong disclosure day.
Oh yeah, DeLong disclosure. It's almost like. It's almost like they planned that. I don't know. Yeah, so let me just say, folks, so tonight's guest is Joshua Kutchin. He's here on the show. He's the author of a couple of great books, A Trojan Feast, The Food and Drink Offerings of Aliens, Fairies, and Sasquatch, as well as The Brimstone Deceit, which is all about paranormal smells, which I just love and is just such a... I was saying in sort of the write-ups for the shows here, these are like outlier aspects of the paranormal, and he's put together like voluminous work on them. It's not just like some throwaway like 150-page book. It's like a monster book, both of them, and he's got another one out or coming out soon that he's wrapping up that's all about fairy lore, and that one I think is going to be even more beastly in size. So he's prodigious, and he's looking at stuff that's on the fringe, and I have a lot of respect for him for doing that because when you've been doing this stuff this long and looking at this stuff this long, when somebody comes along with some new ideas or new avenues of exploration, it's just so fucking refreshing. So I hold him in the highest regard. Anyone heard the show with Ryan Collier knows we were putting him over huge there. So welcome back to the show, Josh, and thanks for joining us. On the 10th and final season of Banal of America. Where'd he go? Oh, he got disconnected. What is going on? Oh, my goodness. Let's see if we get him back. Are you back now?
Hello? Yeah, hey.
My God. I'm not doing all that
gremlins,
again.
The gremlins are strong tonight. I don't know what it is, man. I'm sorry.
Jesus. Anyway,
my phone just rebooted in the middle of your spiel. Sorry about that.
You can listen to it later and have a good cry.
Oh, shucks.
Yeah. Anyway, all right. Hopefully you're back now. I don't know what's going on. But I think we'll be okay, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, my phone just, like, restarted in the middle of your spiel, so I guess I just didn't like the sound of your voice.
Wouldn't be the first time.
If I had a nickel.
Exactly. Well, anyway, now that we've got this rocky two-seater, little flimsy aircraft off the ground, welcome back to the show, dude. It's great to have you, and, you know, I was joking with you. I did a stretch of five first-time guests, and this ties into the in-house notes at the beginning of the show, folks. I was just, like, worn out and needed to take the week off, and then just started pestering Josh nonstop as he was getting ready to come back from Ireland, because I wanted to talk about his trip with him. And the great thing about having somebody who's a dear friend and a good buddy and who's been on the show before is it's a lot less work for me. So I really literally have no notes other than that Josh went to Ireland and he wrote and he's writing a book on fairy lore. So we're just going to see where things go.
Yeah, after my first interview, my very, very, very first interview before I wrote anything, my first interview with Micah, Banal of America, was my first post-book interview. So it's an auspicious day.
Nice. Yeah, I didn't know that, but that's awesome. You probably told me that at some point, but I'm happy to have you back, dude, you know, and I'm carefully choosing the people I have on the final season, so I told you I always wanted to get you on because to be on this final one, because I don't know what the fuck I'm going to be doing, so I want to at least tip people off to, like, the really good folks to be checking out, and you're one of them.
That.
You're putting out, like, such tremendous stuff.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that. You know, you're my brother. I feel like we always have our own clique at Paramania that sort of just, we are the nucleus of that particular sieve.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, we're like a breakaway clique.
Yeah.
So tell me about this trip to Ireland now. You just got back at the end of last week. I guess set it up a little bit, talk about this, just, you know, we'll dig deeper into the fairies later. You know, I know that sets up kind of like this journey to Ireland, although it was also like a family vacation. But, you know, give us sort of the setup in lieu of a bio background, because everybody knows who you are.
It's even before I was into all this stuff, I've always had a soft spot in my life for, you know, I've always been a bit of an Anglophile, and especially, you know, a bit of a Celtophile, so to speak. just like pub life and like the whole Irish, the whole Irish landscape, and just, you know, mythology and everything has really appealed to me. So it's been like, you know, I was talking with my wife post-trip, and I'm like, I don't really know where else I want to go. You know, it's like this has been such a big bucket list moment for me that I'm kind of like, you know, I'm sure there's some other places I'd like to go. But I haven't had an itch that, or I haven't had a scratch that itched this much in a long time. So we went, we basically did we hit some touristy things. We hit, you know, some major cities, but for the most part, it was like, you know, sort of a megalithic tour of the coast. So we started in Dublin, landed in Dublin with zero sleep, nice 36-hour day, and then traveled up the coast to Belfast, then did Belfast up to County Antrim, over to Sligo, and then down to Galway all in one day, which I talked to some locals, and they're like, You came from Belfast and did all that today? Because we had like four or five tourist destinations that day, too. And then spent 2 days in Galway, seeing the burn, and then from Galway to Dingle. Spent 2 nights in Dingle. Because we saw stuff on the way down to Galway. 2 nights in Dingle, then over basically to County Limerick, but stayed on the shores of Lough Gur, which is has a special place in my heart now, and then back into Dublin for the last day. So we saw a ton of the country in a very small amount of time, and, you know, I feel like I need a vacation for my vacation, but at the same time, you know, I feel so much In some ways, I feel a little bit more at peace because I've gotten to see some of these things that I, you know, was wondering, you know, 32, getting ready to have a kid soon, probably. You know, am I ever going to get to see this? And I got to see it. So there's a corner of my mind that's a lot quieter than it used to be, that's for sure.
Nice, nice. Yeah, that sounds fucking amazing, dude. That sounds like I'm amazed in a sense because, like, well, most people when they go on vacation, you know, they just go and stay, like, they would just stay in Dublin for the week or whatever, maybe like a couple of days. So you did like a tour almost. That's badass.
Yeah, my wife was did a great job of really organizing what to see next and sort of the logistics of where we should go and how we should do it. So basically, you know, we went on the, you know, the upper two thirds of the country, and we saw our butts off. We saw so many things. Some of the tourists, like I said, some of the touristy stuff and some stuff that, like, if you brought a tourist to, they would not give a damn about. But, you know, that's sort of the way that I like to do it. There's some definite highlights that I don't think people would expect.
Well, I think a lot of this kind of was informed, in a sense, by the fairy research. Like, was there something you were in particular, like, looking to see amongst other stuff?
I mean, yeah, like 100%. Like, I mean, you know, Dublin, as much as I did enjoy Dublin, you get to a certain point, you know, of seeing stuff, and it becomes sort of just a city.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very historical city, but there's, you know, I'm not the kind of person who's going to go on a ghost bus tour or some, you know, chintzy stuff like that. So I was pretty much, you know, jonesing by the second day to get out of town. That second day, we made it up to Burnaboyne, which I guess I should probably take a step back here and sort of explain what the whole fairy fort thing means in Ireland. So there are a bunch of different, like, according to who you talk to, there are between 40 and 60,000 ring forts, or, you know, fairy forts in Ireland. And they sort of, as I, you know, spent time, I was sort of aware of this tangentially, but as I spent time there in the country, I became more aware of this. They fall into a couple of different categories. You know, you have ring forts that are basically like a, you know, one stone tall that are in a ring that, you know, have trees in the middle. Then you have some ring forts that are, you know, stacked stones, you know, to chest level in these really elaborate fort structures. And then you have some ring forts that are, you know, sort of more like mounds, more like burial mounds, or like stones that have been covered by earth since that, you know, say, over the years. And, and just variations on that in between. So I was wanting to see a lot of those, but what that means is that, you know, a lot of times when you want to go looking for fairy stuff, you're really looking for either, you know, Neolithic or early Christian dwellings. And the idea is that, you know, nobody's really debating that these aren't historical human constructs. The idea is that, you know, the fairy folk since moved into those areas. And it's sort of conflated with this idea, too, that, you know, there's this fine line between the fairy folk and the dead. You'll find tons of literature out there where the dead are seen, you know, carousing with fairy folk. There's a famous fairy poem, one of the earliest extant texts that we still have on fairies, called The Queen of Elfin's Norris. And in it, there's a scene where it says that once you die, there are three paths, one to heaven, one to hell, and one to fairyland. So it's almost like, so fairyland and fairies are sort of tied in with the dead, sort of limbo, sort of psychopomp thing. So you're not only seeing, you know, on the one hand you're seeing mythological stuff, but on the other hand you're seeing very realistic historical ancient sites. So one of the sites between Dublin and Belfast is Burnaboyne, which is a series of megalithic mounds, burial mounds, and they're incredibly well preserved. One of them, Nauth, has 30% of the surviving 30% of the surviving megalithic artwork in Western Europe, in that site alone. Yeah, it's one site that's like, I think it might even be less than an acre. And you know, you look at the artwork, and it's all around these stones, these large stones that are around the base of the largest burial tomb, which is, you know, it looks sort of like a hillock. But the shapes that you see are, you know, circles, concentric circles, snakes, zigzags, spirals, chevrons, triangles, diamonds, that sort of thing. And it was really interesting on the tour that we took, because the tour guide was like, you know, some people say that these are the sort of shapes that you see in an altered state brought on by meditation or other methods. Like, yeah, I wonder what other methods you could possibly be talking about. But, you know, it's interesting to me, too. Like, I mean, those are all shapes that people see in the UFO experience, too. I mean, concentric circles, chevrons, triangles. I mean, it's, you know, it's really sort of one and the same. And I think everybody who's even moderately familiar with my work knows that I have this axe to grind about the similarities between the fairy folk and you know, modern ufology.
I know. It really grinds your gears.
No, it fires my engine more than grinds my gears.
Oh boy!
But
now, let me ask you a question. I'm going to jump in just to so people know that I'm still here. So
yeah, I'm sorry. I haven't talked to anybody about this, so I'm like, I'm really jonesing.
I know, and I tend to get lazy, so I might sit back and then I'll look and be like, shit, the show's over. I got a simple question in a sense, but like, all right, I'll just throw it out there. So like, you're in Ireland though, that's the land of the leprechaun. What's the difference, and is it all sort of because part of me thinks like, oh, do they just call it like leprechaun stuff there, or do they have some differentiation even there between the two entities?
I mean, yeah, if you want to put it in sort of a ufological context, I mean, the leprechaun is to fairy folklore as Area 51 is to, or actually as Roswell is to, you know, ufology. You actually see a lot less.
So it's like a bastardized version, kind of the fairy thing.
It's something that started out with some legitimate, you know, interest and some legitimacy to it, but over time it just sort of became this overly commercialized, diluted thing with just a bunch of junk around it. The difference in terms of fairy lore between the leprechaun and sort of the fairies is that, you know, you generally divide fairies into two categories. You have your trooping fairies, which are the fairies that tend to, you know, go through spots at night. They're the fairies that tend to congregate around burial mounds. And then you have your solitary fairies, which are the fairies that tend to congregate, tend to stay alone, rather, in woods, on, untrodden paths, that sort of thing. So you have your leprechaun, your clericon, and it's almost like, you know, the fairy folk sort of kick the leprechaun out for being Tim Banal, like for being too crusty and too ornery.
Oh, jeez, all right, I get you.
It doesn't have that sort of robust, localized tradition. I mean, like, the places that you would see leprechauns would tend to be the sort of liminal areas like bridges and, you know, the edges of forest. You don't have that connection to fairy mounds and to Neolithic sites that you do with the fairy folk, like the trooping fairies.
Yeah, like a leprechaun, you'll encounter when you're, like, stumbling home drunk or like, I don't know, in a shady alley somehow, you'll run into one.
Yeah, that's the thing. There was, I heard a story while I was there of a supposedly drunk who ran into a leprechaun on the way home. The idea is that if you caught a leprechaun, he was making shoes, and if he was so invested in making shoes that you could actually sneak up behind him and catch him. And if you caught the leprechaun and he did not, and you didn't take your eyes off of him, he would actually be forced to sort of lead you to where he has buried his gold. So in this particular case, a drunk man came up behind a leprechaun and grabbed it by the neck and stared at it, and just sort of, like, as he stared at it, he was asking it where its gold was, and he finally found it. What he ended up doing is he ended up tying a red ribbon around the tree that was beside the treasure, and he told the leprechaun, he said, "I'm going to leave now, but you have to swear for me, or else I won't let you go, that you will not touch the ribbon on this tree." And the leprechaun said, "I swear not." So he goes back to get a spade, and he comes back to where he had tied the ribbon around the tree, and there's a ribbon tied around every tree in sight. So that's the sort of stories that you get from leprechauns. You know, typical trickstery sort of, you know, touristy, sanitized stuff. But, you know, the leprechauns, I actually hear more about the clericon than the leprechaun. And the clericon was, you know, sort of a real bastard. I mean, it's like, imagine everything that you... Imagine the surliness of the leprechaun taken to the clericon.
So So you're at this place now. We'll jump back to the thing. That's all. That's kind of all I wanted to know, because part of me is just like, so they, when you're taking the tour, they are talking about that they're fairies.
No, well, in this particular case, I'm like, they're, you know, trying to be sort of respectful about it. I mean, there are fairy associations with Brenneboyne. I just read the other day about, you know, being a place that was well known to see anomalous lights, like earth lights, like fairy lights. But on this particular tour, they're just emphasizing the megalithic, you know, aspect of it. And if you read between the lines, you can see some of these, you know, these more esoteric aspects. But, you know, on the whole, it's very much about, you know, this is an ancient burial site that, you know, they're very much on the up and up about it being, you know, very sort of materialist history of Ireland sort of attraction.
Yeah. Interesting.
If you want, I'm like, there were fairy tours that you could take, and I didn't take any because I just wanted to find stuff on my own. I noticed an odd trend where whenever I'd ask people about, because there were a couple of different locations that I went to where I was looking actively for a specific fairy fort. And whenever I'd ask, they'd be like, you know, the people that I'd run into would be like, oh, well, I don't know about one around here, but, and they'd start listing, you know, tourist sites, and they'd be like, oh, you find them everywhere, you know, in the south of Ireland or whatever. And it was almost weird because, like, sometimes I would have conversations like that with people, and then, you know, 100 yards down the road, I'd find exactly what I was looking for. And I'm like, you didn't think to mention that to me, that was what, that might be what I was looking
maybe
for?
Maybe it's a weird, so, yeah, maybe it's like a weird thing where it's like, they don't want to send you to the one near them, so they send you to the. They sort of put you off.
Yeah, I think it's one of two things. I think they either become sort of numb to it. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, maybe it's like, you know, creeks in South Georgia or something. It's like, yeah, there's creeks around here. I don't even notice them because I see them all the time. But on the other hand, you know, it does have that sort of like almost Lovecraftian, like, you know, let me steer you away from our town's dark secret sort of thing. Because I have some examples that I can give later where they're like, I can't believe that. Like, I'm literally, well, we might as well skip ahead. Like, one of our days going between Galway to Dingle, I had heard that there was, so I'd seen Brenneboyne, which is, you know, a megalithic burial site, and that's sort of a fairy mound, or fairy fort rather, but not quite, and it's also, you know, it's a tourist site, and I wanted to see something that was like one of these spots that nobody ever goes to. And then I also made the hike up Knocknaree, which we can talk about, put a pin in that, in between the 2 days, but getting back to this example of people just not talking to me about things, we had driven through the Burren, which is a part in Western Ireland, it's very, very rocky and also is rich in folklore, around just to the west of Galway. And I had heard that there was a fairy fort near this town of Ballyvaughan. And, you know, the day before, my wife and I had been on a tour that had passed through Ballyvaughan, and I asked the bus driver, and he said, oh, yeah, it's up there. So the next day on our way out of town, my wife and I sort of went in that direction and had to hop an electric fence into a cow pasture, which the good news is that if you're wearing denim jeans, you can probably straddle an electric fence and the voltage is low enough that it won't electrify you, but you do not want to form a closed circuit with your fist around the wire. Learned that the hard way.
Did you do that?
I definitely did that. I definitely did that.
Did
some
you,
of the stronger ones,
you like shocked?
Oh no, just it was just like a little static electricity shock. Some of the stronger ones you can actually take like a leaf to, and you can touch the leaf to the wire, and you can feel that it's electric through the wire. But this one, I actually crossed over the first time without realizing it was electric because, you know, I had my jeans were slung low and the denim sort of absorbed it, and it wasn't that strong. But, you know, on the way back, I put my hand around it and gave me a little bit of almost like a hand buzzer sort of thing. You know?
Yeah. This is the one you posted the picture of that you trespassed.
The very first one. Yeah, the very first one. So we went in the direction that he pointed us to, and it was wrong. But I'd heard that there was one on this specific road near this community. So I'm like, I'm at the end of the road, and it ends like it says. There's a sign that says cul-de-sac, and it's a one-lane dirt road. And I'm like, there's got to be something around here. So I continue down the dirt road, and I run into, as you do in Ireland, somebody walking along the path, because there were so many people, the towns are so small, and a lot of people just walk to places in Ireland, which I think is part of the reason that they have, or, you know, are still more in touch with their surroundings, because, you know, they're spending more time in transit. But we talked with this guy for a little bit, and I said, you know, do you know if there's a ring fort I don't want to sound like a crazy person saying, you know, are the fairies down here? Is there a ring fort down here?
Yeah.
He's like, oh, I think there's a ring fort. Yeah, there's. And he goes into like the touristy ring fort, and I said, no. I said, is there one down this road? And he goes, oh, maybe, but I'm not sure if you can get to it. And he says, you want to see this? You want to see these other ones? Continue on down, you know, continue down this road and turn around the cul-de-sac, and you should go to these others. Which we ended up going to some of those other sites, and they were fine, but they weren't, you know, again, they weren't like the nitty-gritty that I was looking for. So I continue.
Yeah. So they just
like,
keep giving you the brush off. This is so weird.
Yeah, and I continue. I go down, like, again, we pass him. He's heading in the direction that we're driving. And I pass him, and in like less than 200 yards, there's this little pull-in beside a pasture, and there's like a textbook-perfect ring fort. Now, it isn't the ring fort that has the giant mound, but it definitely is the ring fort that's about two stones deep of a circle of stones. And you can tell on the inside that nobody has touched this thing. You know, it's one of the lower-profile ring forts, but it's also just like it's absolutely like. You could look at it. If you know what you're looking for, you could look at it and say, it's exactly it. And I found a couple other ones that I wasn't able to get to because they were farther off the highway. And I'm freaking out because this is exactly what I wanted to see. And, of course, he catches up with us. And I said, this has got to be the ring fort. And he looks and he goes, oh, I suppose so. And then he talks to us. Then he talks to us about gun control in America for about, you know, 3 minutes. And then he walks along. So I said, yeah, it's just weird. So I say to my wife, I say, look, here's the thing. I don't know if I'm ever going to get back here. I've traveled 8 hours across an ocean. I'm not going to do anything nefarious. It's the middle of the day. I can't see this person's, this landowner's house. I can't go up and ask him. Like, I'm just going to pop this cattle gate, and I'm going to go up to this ring fort. Spend less than 10 minutes on his land. So we pull down the road a little bit until the guy walks out of sight and he thinks that we've left, and then I back up. And I hopped the fence, and I got out there, and it was, even though that was the first of, like, probably seven different fairy sites that I saw, it was, in a lot of ways, the most impactful for me because, A, you know, it's not a tourist destination. It's just sitting out here on private land. But, B, like, it was incredible. Some of the pictures that I posted, I think, kind of get this across, but, like, everything in Ireland is so green and lush and beautiful. And I would say about 3 feet into this fairy ring, it's dark. The trees look sickly, and there's no light coming through. It was the starkest representation of like inside the woods, outside the woods that I've ever seen. So
it was pretty amazing. I was looking at those pictures that you posted. It's like
And
it looked kind of like a hut almost in a sense. Like, did the it looked seemed like the trees kind of curled, like it was a very tight sort of ring looking thing. Like you could go, you like went in, like almost like you had like crouch into like a, almost like a little structure almost.
Yeah, I mean you would have to do that. And of course, you know, to be clear, I didn't ever penetrate the ring. there were some more touristy sites. There were some more touristy sites that I actually entered. Fairy forts, but with something like that that obviously hadn't been touched, that was on private land, I'm like, I'm not going at all. So, you know, every morning, we stayed in a couple of different bed and breakfasts, and every morning, you know, they come by, wow, you really seem to like your toast. I'm like, yeah, I do, and I'm shoving toast in the pockets of my jacket because I'm taking them for offerings to leave at the fairy fort. So I ended up leaving some toast there, and I took a little video, which is going to be, I think, Soraya is going to share it with Where Did the Road Go patrons, but I took videos of all the different fairy forts that I went through and described some stuff, but that one, even though it wasn't, you know, a recognized example, I showed it to some other people, like, this is what I think it is, right? And somebody's like, oh, yeah, I've got one on my property. It looks exactly like that. So this was my baby because it was something that I've written about at length that I have seen for the first time. And I found it, you know, regardless of how much trouble I had finding it, I found it myself. So I was absolutely beside myself for the rest of that day. It was astounding for me. So I know a lot of people are like,
now, is there like a place where you can report that? Is it the kind of thing, does someone keep track of these things, or is it sort of like, I mean, you say you knew of some places where they were, like, who tracks this stuff? Is there a place that does?
Well, That's the thing that sort of has astounded me.
Offended you?
It astounded me because, I mean...
Oh, astounded. I thought you said offended.
Yeah.
I was like, Jesus.
It astounded me because, you know, you read about 40 to 60,000 ring forts on an island about the size of Indiana. Like, so you think that you'd be seeing them all the damn time, right? It wasn't until several days into the trip that I realized that they're actually kind of hard to see because, you know, a couple different reasons. There are hedges everywhere in Ireland. Like, I recommend anybody who goes to Ireland, take a bus tour for one day just so you can see over the damn hedges, because so much of the time you, like, see, like, you know, this entrance into a pasture. You're like, wow, it's really beautiful. And then for the next, you know, half mile, you're just staring at this wall of bushes.
Weird.
So that's sort of, you know, it's stymie you finding these. But the other thing is that if you're viewing these at eye level, a lot of times they just look like hills. And until you know what you're looking for, like, I'm sure that I passed, again, with as much as we traveled, I'm sure that I passed, like, probably upwards of 500 of these things. But between perspective and being able to get out and see them and being able to get out to them, you know, you can't always pinpoint them. Of course, you know, once you know what to look for, by day four, you've seen so many that it's like, oh, it's another fairy fort. But that was the first one where I was like, this is unambiguously exactly what I'm looking for, 100%. Do you do show notes or anything for BOA?
We do a recap. Why, you want me to, I'll throw the pictures up or a link to the pictures.
Are they
on your website? Do you have a website?
I'll send them to you, and I also, I'll be putting up a post soon, too. Because, again, this is sort of me circling back around to your original question. I'd like to sort of put out a couple of examples of what these look like, because they can look very different from fairy fort to fairy fort. I'm astounded that there has not been some sort of enterprising graduate student who hasn't gone through and tried to record these. I mean, if these were in America, every single one would probably have a national park around it, just for the, you know, the prehistoric heritage significance alone. But, you know, they're so rich with this sort of history that they're just almost literally tripping over them. People have them on their private land, and I will post them to my website and also send some your way, because, like I said, they take a couple of different forms in terms of how they look. But, you know, a lot of the times the tradition is still very much respected. I mean, it was obvious that this farmer had not done anything to this grove. It's self-contained in a ring of rocks. Like I said, a ring of rocks too deep, stacked one high. And he hadn't done anything to it. Interestingly enough, the cows obviously hadn't been passing through there, and there were some, you know, groves and such where you could see cattle pass that had gone through, but the cows hadn't disturbed us at all. It's sort of like the old thing that you hear about people doing in Iceland, rerouting around ferry locations. I mean, there are stories of you know, construction projects that reroute around not only ferry forts, but also reroute around alleged fairy trees, which are, you know, whenever you see a single tree in a field, especially if it's a hawthorn tree, that is a fairy tree or a fairy bush, and if you mess with it, then you're going to suffer bad luck.
Okay, now I'm confused, though. We got to circle back to my problems with, I'm like that episode of The Office. But in Iceland, they're elves. But are we still talking sort of about the same I'm sure there's sort of a regional taxonomy, but are these entities essentially kind of the same thing?
No, fairy studies tend to lump together. I mean, when you talk about fairies, it's sort of a catch-all. Number one, you probably wouldn't call them fairies. You'd call them the gentry or the good folk or the people of peace or the fair folk. But the fairies
are
catch-all.
What about elementals? Is that kind of like the modern version?
Hey, come on, slow down.
What?
Elementals are a Victorian interpretation of what the fairy folk probably meant. Really, when you drill down to it, the fairy folk were probably associated with an animistic pagan land spirits. But the term fairies really does encapsulate fairies, leprechauns, elves, as you mentioned. But also things like trolls, even tall things like giants are considered part of the fae folk taxonomy. Mermaids are considered part of the fairy folk. because they all do blend together and they all sort of share the same values and methods by which they kidnap people and by the same sort of methods by which they operate, the same sort of rules that apply, you know, that idea that if you go to visit the fairies, if you go to visit a giant, you can't eat from a giant. If you go to visit from a mermaid, you can't eat from the mermaid. And go to visit the fae folk, you can't eat from the fae folk either because you'll be trapped with them forever. So that's really what they all are. Again, the place that I've arrived at is that this is probably describing some sort of phenomena that's very much closely associated with the dead. I think that there is some validity to the idea that fairies are psychopomps. They are sort of spirits that facilitate interaction with our world and the world of the dead. You can't get around the fact that a lot of these fairy forts, these fairy sites are, you know, they're literally prehistoric sites where people have found, like, prehistoric arrowheads, prehistoric, you know, campfire sites. Like, these are unambiguously human sites. But there is also, at the same time, simultaneously, this association with these, you know, earth spirits. So trying to reconcile those two is sort of where I'm at right now. I'm kind of settling on this idea that they're intercessor spirits between the world of the dead and the world of the living.
Hmm. Okay. So these hedges are a problem in Ireland. Now, you joked with me about fairy lights. Talk a little bit about this, because did you do anything like that, trying to see if you can, I don't know what you can really do, right? You just be outside at night, right? I don't know what else.
Yeah, well, yeah, no, exactly. And yeah, so you can go outside at night, and when you do that with a wife who loves you and supports your stuff, but it doesn't want to spend 2 hours outside. Like, I remember one night we stayed out, and she was like, you really need Tim and Greg here. They'd stay up with you. My thing is if I'm honest in my heart of hearts, I am respectful of the idea of these fairy folk, but I'm not afraid of the idea of seeing the fairy folk or interacting with the fairy folk if there is some sort of objective reality to it. What I'm afraid of is the bad luck that you hear. I mean, I'm sure you've heard about people who take rocks from certain sacred sites in Hawaii.
Their
luck is so bad that these national parks in Hawaii actually receive shipments of rocks coming to them because people are like, I took a rock and now my luck, you know, my car broke down and my uncle has cancer and all this stuff. So, like, that's what I'm afraid of, is that sort of thing.
I can see that. Yeah. It's bad mojo in some instances.
So that's why I was always very respectful, and I didn't take anything, and I always made sure to, like, you know, stock up on bread and toast from the bed and breakfast. For the trip, so that I could always leave something behind. There was once or twice where I didn't have any bread, so I left a coin behind. Just something that just says, you know, if you're real, don't be mad at me for being here. Which I think in this case, intent is everything. So with that in mind, I was sort of, a little bit hesitant to go out of these space spots at night. But when we went to, County Limerick, this is a site that I could talk about ad nauseum, this area. There were a couple of different sites, a couple of different megalithic sites. One of them is the largest stone circle in Ireland, where I had something, probably the weirdest thing on my trip happened to me. We can talk about that if you want to.
Oh.
But there were also two fairy forts there called Carrigal, two different ring forts. Now, these are the ring forts that don't look like the one that I saw first time. These are ones that are about chest high or a little bit, you know, waist high or chest high. And they're stacked stones, several stones deep. A lot of these ancient stone structures don't use masonry of any sort. They're just stacked stones. It's incredible that they're as stable as they are. But these are stacked stone. These are stacked stone ring forts. In this case, they weren't, you know, sometimes you see them and there isn't any vegetation growing on them. But these had a little bit of, you know, vegetation and a little bit of growth where they're starting to blend into the countryside a little bit. But I went to these two fairy forts at night around Loch Gur, and I stood out there for a while and nothing happened. It was dead as a doornail. I left my little bed and breakfast bread behind, but that's about
now,
as good as I got
places,
for that.
I'm a man now, because the ones you just described sound kind of, maybe I'm just, because maybe all these sort of Irish names blend together, but I feel like I've kind of maybe heard. Are these places popular in a Stonehengean way, where it's like, were you the only one there to see this cool stuff, like the largest stone monument there in Ireland, or were there's like actual other people there?
Well, I mean, there are 60,000, so they can't all be that popular.
Right. Well, that one's the largest. I don't know if they like have a little, you know, a gift shop and everything. That's kind of where the nail I'm driving here.
No. I mean, they're even the most popular ones that I saw. The most popular one that I saw, which was actually strikingly well preserved, was a fairy ring fort right at the beginning of what's called the Dingle Loop, which is sort of the loop that you do around the Ring of Dingle, which sounds even dirtier than the Dingle Loop.
Yeah.
But the beginning of the Ring of Dingle, there's some enterprising farmer who has set up, you know, fairy forts and sheep petting in the same spot. So, like, you know, me and my wife, something for everybody, right? Fairy fort, sheep.
Yeah.
So that's the most popular one that I saw. You paid like €3 and you got to walk along the fairy fort. It was actually a really good representation, or really well preserved, I should say, because there was the stone structure, but over time you could tell where, you know, sod had eventually covered it, and it was covered with, you know, fairy thorns around the top. But even that had, like, I think at the most, like, 4 people beside it. So you're not going to run into, like, a gift shop or anything like that. And that was the most popular one that I saw. Most people don't care about these things. To the folklorists, the archaeologists are kind of a big deal, or the Forcian, but to most people they aren't that big a deal. Now, that particular ring fort at Dingle was made up of two separate circular mounds inside each other. So there's sort of a trough in the middle. And you can see, especially in that example, because that was quite tall. I have some pictures of that as well. I'd say like the tops of that fairy fort were about 15 feet tall, probably. And you know, you could walk through the trench with a 15-foot wall on either side. And you can see in that example why some early farmers would actually take their livestock to protect them at night in the ring forts, which is something that apparently was quite a common practice at one point.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it's not like, for example, so going out there at night after dark to these two that I went to at night, there was nobody around at all.
Okay.
Not to mention the fact that it was like, that particular location was a spot in County Limerick called Loch Gur, which is actually, it's a site in Ireland. It's an area of the country that has been continuously inhabited for about 8,000 years. Kind of a big deal. In terms of archaeological significance, it's a huge deal. I think a lot of people would go there and find it boring, but I found it absolutely fascinating. There are multiple cairns, multiple stone circles, multiple fairy forts in that area. The primary things that we visited that day, in addition to a ruined church, were the two fairy forts at Carrigal, another site called the Giant's Tomb, which is a megalithic standing tomb, pretty short. But the really cool thing was the largest stone circle in Ireland, actually.
Yeah, you said the weirdest thing on the trip happened to you there. I wasn't going to let that go. So what was the weird thing that happened?
So you know me, like, you know that I, well, no, of course I do. I'm not a woo guy. Like, I'm not going to make up things that don't happen. I said I'm not a woo guy.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I'm you would make up, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so, somewhere between wanting to believe and not wanting to make up stuff, like, that's sort of where I sit. So we actually made the great decision to hire a private tour. It was actually a gentleman who had spent all of his life in Loch Gur and actually went to get a master's in archaeology and came back and helped sort of found the Heritage Center there. An elderly gentleman by the name of Michael Quinlan, who kept calling me Jake, and I just didn't have the courage to correct him. I was like, sure, I'll be Jake.
Was he doing it in a grandfatherly way?
Yeah, and it was like having Tolkien like take you around all these ancient spots. So it was really charming.
Calling you by the wrong name. Yeah.
Calling me the other way. Yeah. So it's like Tom Banal. Hey Tommy. Yeah.
Oh, that would drive me crazy.
Yeah, I just had to swallow with my pride, but He was a really interesting character because he was very well informed about the archaeological realities of the site, but was also very open to the other sort of more Fortean aspects of it. And so after talking to us about the construction of the stone circle, let me get my notes here. The stone circle was actually constructed. It's actually 400 years older than Stonehenge. Circa 3000 BC. Some of the largest stones were from 3 miles away. It's well known because it's said that the sun will rise and set between the entrance points on the solstices and the equinox. In reality, that's not
like,
true.
Like a Stonehenge.
Yeah, but in reality, it's a little bit off. It's actually, rises and sets on May 1st and August 1st in one example, and November 1st, which are not the solstice, they're quarter days, which are between solstices.
Well, tectonic plates and whatnot.
Well, yeah, that's the other thing. Yeah, I was thinking about that earlier because there was something that, I can't remember what I saw, but there was another site where something had shifted because of tectonic movement. I'm like, well, that totally could account for something like that.
I wish that you and I had the I could see you doing this, but I wish that I had the wherewithal to. We need to find like a scientist who could like take that spot and like plug it in to some kind of computer program and show where it should be if it did match up with the solstices.
Oh, I think that if you could actually get somebody interested, that could totally be determined.
I know. That's the cool part. It's like, I wouldn't know how to do that, but some astronomer, if any astronomer types are listening, that would be a cool project to do.
Yeah, I mean, it was fascinating. It was, trying to remember, it was 113 stones, 150 feet across. And so the site has a lot of folklore attached to it. Supposedly there was a musician who wanted to learn how to play the harp, and he fell asleep in the stone circle, and when he woke up, supposedly he came back into town, and the fairies had taught him how to play, Shades of the Old Blues Guy at the Crossroads.
Yeah, exactly, that's what I was thinking.
But, and so there's some Wiccans who like to go there and have their, have their moments late at night, but this particular gentleman said, have you ever heard of ley lines? I'm like, dude, have I? yeah, I have. And he said he had said that he had been out there with people with dowsing rods, and their dowsing rods go crazy. He said that he had been out there with a psychic who claimed that under one spot she had gotten a vision of basically a Neolithic sacrifice where these druids sliced a woman's throat open with their canine tooth. Yeah, and my thing was, it's coming from a psychic, I'll believe that more than I'll believe, like, this is a place where the vibrations are higher. I would believe
yeah,
this place.
Yeah.
If you see a lot of these circular areas, they think had served a ritual purpose in terms of like providing seating or providing an elevated spot for people to see what's happening in the center of the ring.
It could be like how there. Nowadays, there's like pubs on every corner. At least they were in London, or like how every house has a TV. Where it's like 3,000 years ago was like you didn't have a TV, dude. You had a mound, and that's what we did.
Exactly.
We hung around the mound, and the dude told stories. And now they call them fairy rings. 3,000 years later.
Yeah, no, it's. I mean, I think it's entirely. it makes as much sense as anything else.
And here, I'll blow your mind now, Kutch, because then it's like, think about that, right? But then think about sort of like all of that concentrated, accumulated sort of psychical energy. You know what I'm saying? Like if you took all of your life experiences watching TV and like quantified that energy is still at the mound, like from all those people, from all that time. It's like somehow the energy stuck at the mounds.
I mean, can you imagine focusing on something that is a natural, not natural because it was created by humans, but like something that's physical in nature with no distractions you know, and say what you want to about some ideas of, you know, the, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with the stone tape theory of hauntings and whatnot, but the idea that, you know, certain spots in the land or certain, you know, mineral deposits can actually sort of record and record or hold energy of some sort. Like, yeah,
yeah,
I think that's
what I'm talking about. Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, to that end, like, the guide was like, you know, he spent 45 minutes just standing there talking with us about this. And he said, I want to leave
you. He's tapping into that energy.
yeah, exactly. Well, he was sprightly. He was about 80-something, but he was, you know, kicking my butt. By the way, this is the only trip that I've ever come back weighing less than I left because, like, we were averaging about 20,000 steps, and, like, at least half of that was uphill. Yeah, that's so much climbing.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, I was exhausted. Like, I there were some days where I changed shirts halfway through the day because I was just soaked through.
But
case,
you loved every
minute
of it.
Oh, yeah, no, every minute, dude. I was like, yeah, if I could exercise like that, I would be, you know, skinny as a rail if I had that sort of goal. But, you know, Michael, at some point, he was like, you know, I've talked to you for a little while, told you about the history of the circle. Because I'm going to do two things. Like, first of all, I'm going to step away so you can have about 5 to 10 minutes just to spin here, the two of you yourselves. And this is at, like, 2:30 in the afternoon. There's nobody around. Now, granted, it's not tour season, but I also think that has something to do with the fact that just people don't go to this place. So we're sitting here in the Grange Stone Circle, the Loch Gur Stone Circle, you hear it called, or you'll hear it called the Grange Stone Circle. And he says, I want you to go over to this particular stone. He points to it, and it's the largest stone in the entire ring. It's 13 feet high. It weighs 40 tons.
Wow.
And I found out later it's named the Black One because it's named, which is not ominous at all. It's named after a Celtic mythological figure that brought grain to the Celtic people.
Jesus.
But he says, I want you to close your eyes and put your head against that. He says, some people feel like they're energized when they do that. And so, you know me, I kind of love for something to happen. And at the same time, I think probably nothing's going to happen.
That's exactly how I am.
Yeah, like, I'd love for something to happen. Probably nothing's going to happen.
Right, yeah. Like, I really wish something would happen, but I'm working cynical, so I'm like, nothing's going to happen. You know, it's my luck. It's my luck. I'm not going to, yeah.
Exactly. So I went up to it, and I put my, I closed my eyes, put my forehead against it, and nothing happened. I said, well, that's sort of disappointing. But, you know, we were just there for a little bit. I left my little, you know, my loaf, my breakfast loaf on one of the rocks just to be safe. I'm just leaving bread all over Ireland to cover my ass.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, I should check, like, the BBC. They're going to be like, it seems that the bread terror has stopped in Ireland. We don't know why. We don't know who was putting bread all over the northern part of the country, but it appears it stopped. It could be a prank from flat earth people. We don't know.
I'm like, or I'm a Hansel and Gretel cosplay or something. Yeah.
But anyway, so I
go back up to the stone, and I close my eyes and put my forehead against it, and I'm doing this for probably about 20 seconds. And then this happened to me later because we went back there that night, and I did it again, and I didn't think it would happen, and it happened again. And both times I pushed away, and I really wish I just sort of leaned into it. But after about 20 seconds, I felt like my forehead became slippery and I could feel myself falling forward into the rock.
Whoa.
And
nice.
This happened for about like about a second before I pushed myself back, you know, just as a reaction. And it was weird.
Like you're falling.
I'll be honest,
yeah, like,
it was
I know
weird.
Exactly. Yeah. It's kinda like when you start falling asleep. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It was like that sort of like falling backwards asleep, but you're falling forward and like I can't get over how slippery the center of my forehead was. Now, maybe I just, you know, maybe I have some, you know, active pores or something pouring out grease and oil or something, but it was strange. It happened again that night, and I really wish that I had the courage to sort of sit with that feeling, but both times it happened, I pushed myself away. And I went back to the car.
Well, now you know. Now you know to do it.
Yeah,
next time. You have to go back.
I mean, yeah, I anybody who listens to Where Did the Road Go, I'm sort of reminded of the Jeff Ritzman crystal experiment that he keeps on talking about.
I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Well, we can talk about it later. That's a shout out for my fans, Tim.
I understand. There you go. You got to cross promote, baby.
But went back to the car, and he asked me if, you know, I did that, and I felt anything, and I sort of explained to him what I did, and he goes, "Oh, yeah, that's how it starts. It's just beginning to start." I'm like, that's a cryptic thing to say. What do you, I'm sheepish in person, so I shouldn't end up not saying anything, but that's definitely the strangest thing. If anybody is anywhere near there in County Limerick, we spent a day there. I could have probably spent 2 days there. This was just the largest stone circle. He was talking about there being, you know, about 3 or 4 different stone circles within a kilometer of there. So it's just incredibly rich area, that Loch Gur area. Loch Gur also has the mountain known as Knockfinnel. And Knockfinnel is one of 4 sites in Ireland, supposedly, that has an entrance to Tírnanog, or a fairyland.
Oh.
It's a hollow mountain. Didn't get to see that. Like, I would have loved to have seen it, but, man, we were hustling the entire day. And if you do that, like, definitely get a guided tour with Michael from the visitor center, because it was so incredible. And again, like,
do
it
soon,
like,
he's
very
old.
Yeah, he's old, but yeah, it's interesting because, like, he is from a family that's there, and he knows, like, he's sort of the town historian, and it's really fascinating. And there was another, what else happened? There was a cromlech, and, you know, an outcropping of rock that he pointed us to. And he would say these things, would be like, man, you're blending your folklore and your mythology together, your folklore rather, and your history together really well. So he said, "You see that cromlech over there?" And he said, "Yeah." And he was talking to us about the, you know, the oppression of Catholics, and how, you know, at one point it was, you know, an extremely exorbitant price to bring in Catholic priests' heads, and people had to worship in secret, and they would pick these cromlechs, these outcroppings of rock, to worship at. And he said, this particular one has a worship spot, and there's actually a cavern inside. And I said, that's interesting, a really, really good, like, fact-based historical stuff. And he said, people will ask me how I know this, and I tell them because I saw it. He goes, I went in there, and if you touch a certain spot in the stone, you'll see a stairway open up. And if you go down the stairway, there's the most beautiful chapel down there. And I've seen it. I've seen it with my own eyes. It's beautiful. Like, well, why aren't we over there, dude? Like, you can't drop that knowledge bomb. And then, like, you know, on the next slide, he'll talk to us about, you know, soil strata that was collected from a certain area, so they were able to date it because, you know, there wasn't enough evidence from, you know, electrocarbon dating. Like, he was a great mix of, like, this really mysterious folklore thing and also this, like, hard science-y archaeology thing. In some ways, it was the highlight of my trip, that whole area.
Interesting. So wait, he says gone down and touched. No. I know. I'm listening and enjoying. So he says he goes down and touches. He's touched the. My first inclination would be like, all right, dude, let's go. Let's go touch the rock. I want to see this chapel. That sounds amazing. I didn't fly all the way out here to, you know.
Yeah.
Or,
it was like,
or
it was
he'd
like,
just give you some cheeky answer where he'd be like, only on a rainy Wednesday.
Ironically, it was a rainy Wednesday. So.
Oh, Jesus! See, we're tapped into something tonight.
Yeah, to be fair, it was about half a mile away across the field, and like there's this guy who, like, you can tell has hip problems, and I'm like, I'm not gonna ask you to do that. You know, and I guess I should have, you know, manned up and trespassed a little bit more, but, you know.
Yeah, well, you'd be in there slapping every different rock, because who knows which one it is. That's how they'd get
you. Yeah, exactly.
That's how they'd arrest you. They'd be like, we found him slapping rocks inside a cavern on some dude's farm.
Yeah.
And so he's sadly, in Ireland, that's like a federal offense. So you're doing,
yeah,
you're doing like 10 years in Irish prison, rock slapping.
Yeah. <that's... laughs> Rock goblins.
Exactly. They'd be like, we're really sorry. It's an old law that's on the books. You have to go to jail now for, like, at least 7 years. At least. And you're just like, I was in just a cave. I was hitting rocks, dude. What are you talking about?
To be fair, I walked uninvited on more private land than I have probably ever in my life.
Yeah, but you were a guest in their country, and you had good intentions. I think that's okay.
Well, that and the fact that the entire time I was like, you know what, at least they don't have automatic firearms in this country, so I'm probably, like, I can survive a shotgun, right? Like, he's going to be far enough away. I can see him coming before the shotgun affects me, right?
Is that what the guy said to you about gun control? Or he was like, he's like, have fun in our country.
No.
Don't worry about getting shot.
So after, like, not talking, we're jumping all over the place, folks. I'm sorry about this. But
it's been all America. They're here to listen to us. They don't care what
I know. I'm just,
we talk
I'm just
about.
So effervescent that I feel like I'm jumping all over the place. But
dude,
after,
that's mostly my fault,
yeah.
I think, because I have no... the itinerary better than I do. I'm just like, what's an elf?
after basically ignoring my question about a ferry fort, the guy catches up with us, you know, that first day, the first ferry fort we saw, and it's less of a conversation about, gun control in America. It's more of it was a lecture. It was like, you know, we have some problems in this country, but we can't figure out America's obsession with firearms. And I'm like, dude, spare me the NPR shit. Like, I just want to see the ferry fort. You know, I'm on vacation. I have nuanced views about this. Just stop.
I think it's because we're the only – here's a – I'll answer that question. I think it's because we're the only – and I'm not even a gun maniac country, or at least in recent, like, history or whatever, and I'm sure there'll be people that correct me about this, that we owe our existence to guns in a sense. Like, we rose up and drove out the British by shooting them and getting them out of here. It was like, you know, that's how it is. So it's a weird, like, psychological thing.
I think that's one very good answer on
a very complex issue.
A very complex spectrum, yeah. But I think that should not be ignored. I also think the fact that trying to pass legislation for somebody who lives in an urban center versus somebody who lives in Montana and has to actually deal with pumas and actually deal with wolves, like that, those are, you can't expect the same, you know, the same legislation to cover those two different lifestyles, you know?
Right.
And I think that, you know, that there is a legitimate role for some people to have more higher-powered firearms in some parts of the country than others, you know, which is why I think that the idea of more, you know, state sovereignty is probably, I'm always against centralization. That's sort of my shtick. The less centralized things are, the better, because it ensures, you know, the farther you are from, personally for me, not to get off on an entire political tangent, but for me, like, the farther you are from the source of a problem, the less likely you are to have a solution for it. And the closer you are, the more you can actually deal with that. The closer you are, the more you can actually deal with that problem.
Absolutely.
So decentralization is sort of one of my guiding political, you know, philosophies. But that's not something I'm going
to
talk to you about.
I was just speaking to the obsession, like why are people obsessed with guns here? It's just like, because it's like been around since the birth of the country, you know. Like in England, I assume England became a country like before guns were invented. But maybe I'm a complete idiot. I don't.
I think you've got a really good point there. I really do. And I think that there are enough examples of, you know, of countries where just prior to a fascist takeover, they have confiscated guns, and that sort of self-reinforces and makes us, you know, makes us a little bit, pardon the pun, gun shy. But, you know, at the same time, like, I don't think that anybody in America needs an assault weapon, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. No, it's a very weirdly complex. If anything, it should be decentralized in a sense where it's like they should be different laws for the dude in Montana than the person who lives in Philadelphia or whatever. Like then they'd say, oh, it's not fair, but it's like a dude in an apartment in Philadelphia doesn't need like 300 guns, dude. Like, it's just,
exactly.
You know. Like, only bad things can happen. So, like, let's just, and a dude in Montana, fine. Like, that's cool, because he's in the middle of fucking nowhere.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you.
If you live in Philadelphia in an apartment and you want to own 300 guns, like, move to fucking Montana so no one, so we don't have to worry about you.
Yeah.
Or someone's stealing all your shit. That's the other part. Someone's just taking it. Like, Jesus.
Well, and you know, like I have friends who have relatives who have died because of gun violence, and I have musician friends who have told me that if they weren't hearing a piece in New Orleans coming back from a gig at 4 a.m, they wouldn't be here today. You know,
God,
because all they had to do was right. But all they had to do was flash it, and like the people who were going to mug him turned tail and ran because they just didn't want the trouble. So, like, I think there's a lot more nuance to the conversation we have, but that's not what we do, and that's also not what I'm going to do when I'm standing on a gravel road in Ireland trying to find my damn theory for it.
Exactly.
So, he's trying to have this conversation, and especially with all this Las Vegas thing. Like, I'm not...
Should have just given him my number. Should have been like, here, call this guy. He'll be able to talk to him. He's doing nothing right now.
Just an open lines, an all open lines episode of Banal of America.
it's just at my house at like 4 in the afternoon. Some Irish guy calls. Joshua Cushing gave me your number. I need to talk to you about your gun control.
Yes.
Like, all right, what's your problem, guy? I got nothing going on.
You're like, well, at least you don't only talk sexy like the last guy. Okay.
So, all right, I'm trying to think of, like, because I don't know much in a sense about the Irish, the stuff you were going to see out there. So what other things did – it sounds like such a, like, shitty question, but, like, what other things did you see, of the esoteric bent that people might be thrilled by?
Yeah, so in the non-fairy fort sort of realm, and again, we could talk about probably about fairy rings and such forever, which is why I'm glad that I took videos and I'm going to post some pictures as well. There are probably about two other sites that I think are worth mentioning that I visited that sort of are in sort of Fortean category. The first one was Knocknarie, and this was the day that we were coming from Belfast through County Antrim over to Sligo and then down to Galway, which in case anybody doesn't know, that's about 6 to 7 hours in the car without sightseeing. Somehow on that day we were still able to cram in the Giant's Causeway, Bushmill Distillery, Knocknarie, and what else did we do that day? We also did Dunluce Castle. Like, we did a couple things that day and had sit-down lunch. So we were very busy bees that day. Yeah, we were busy bees that day. So one of the things that we did is on our way down to Galway, we stopped in Sligo, which is on the northwestern coast. And there was one location that I wanted to see, and I talked to a couple of people who were sort of a folklore bent. They're like, "Oh, you went here? It's really impressive that you went up there." It's a mountain, basically. I didn't realize that when I wanted to go there at the time, but it's a mountain with a giant stone cairn at the top, which is supposedly the resting place of the Queen of the Fairies, Queen Mab or Queen Maeve. Obviously, it doesn't quite – that's not the way actual fairy lore works, but that's just sort of the local, local legend. It's probably really just a Neolithic burial site, but definitely a ritualistic space because the view from the top of this place is incredible. But we got there just before dark, and I didn't realize – I thought we were just going to walk to a field and find a stone cairn out there. But, no, we had to walk up a legitimate mountain, and I took some videos of it because, like, the surrounding view was maybe one of the most incredible sights I've seen in my life. I haven't done a lot of travel outside the country, but I've seen just about every national park in this country, and this was one of the most astounding, jaw-dropping views I've seen. But to get there, you have to hike through a field full of cow shit, and then you have to climb up the mountain after that. We did this, and I went up there. So if you take a rock from the top of from Queen Mab's grave, it's bad luck.
I thought you were gonna say. I thought you were gonna tell me like it was supposed to be good luck, and I'm gonna be like, "No catch." Yeah.
Well, guys, I got that backwards, guys. No wonder I had this rash.
The wrong thing.
Yeah. No wonder I'm breaking out in hives. Oh my god. But if you take a rock and put it on Queen Mab's grave, that's considered good luck.
Oh.
So
nice.
I definitely did
that.
I did that. I didn't leave any. I don't think I left any bread that day. Because I knew I was bringing up the rocks. But I went up there and filmed a little video right there at like right at sunset. I mean, it was perfect. And like again, you had to put in some effort to get to the top of this thing. So we saw two people on the trail. That might have been a function of the time of day, but at the same time, like both of them were locals. There was nobody here. You know, it was like you know.
Middle-aged people having exercise.
Yeah.
They're like, we walk up and down the mountain every day, buddy. It's not hard.
Yeah. So that was quite incredible just to see that, not only this incredible site and this incredible view, but also the megalithic history. We went to the Nakma Woods, which were in a lot of fairy lore, supposedly like ground zero for the fairy kingdom.
I like creepy forest.
There were a couple of structures in there, but nothing had that real fairy spring fort feel. There are two cairns which I looked for that I could not find, nor could I find anybody to help me find them. But having said that, two cairns, so two stone mounds that were supposedly at the top of the hill. I was not able to find them.
Need a glossary here. I don't understand. Yeah.
Oh yeah, no, there's multiple terms for everything and every. You know, the multiple terms for everything, and all the terms are nothing you've ever heard of before. So
exactly, So I'm sorry, I don't mean a cairn, I mean a cacatatus.
Yeah,
I don't mean at all.
But there are two cairns that we weren't able to find. We did find a small stone structure. But at the same time, you're walking around the woods of the fairies, so, you know, it's pretty cool just to be there. We did find some burial mounds in an adjacent park that was not open, where I, again, did some light trespassing.
I don't think it counts too much as trespassing.
Yeah,
I guess they won't extradite me for
trespassing on, you know.
Well,
public,
if you keep going on the radio and bragging about it, they will.
No, I'm not. I honestly.
Admitting you're the bread bandit or whatever they've taken to calling you now. That's tomorrow's headline. They're like, we've got a major break in the Bread Bandit case. He's in America. His name is Joshua Cutchin. He was on a radio show last night bragging about being the Bread Bandit. And now we're demanding that President Trump send him back to Ireland to be tried for slapping stones.
You know, if it meant going back to Ireland, I might do that.
I would watch a TV show with that premise.
That'd be great.
You were sent back to go on trial for a ridiculous series of trespassing capers. Oh, man. So this forest, it's scary. What about ghosts? Is that a big thing out there?
Not a scary forest.
I know it is, but I mean.
It's just a beautiful forest. Not a scary forest, just a beautiful forest. Here's the thing. It's such an old country that like you're up to your eyeballs in ghosts. So
that's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah. But having
well,
said
the thing
that,
is, it's
I
funny because
have...
I bet you someone else do the same exact trip you just did, but go to all these different haunted bed and breakfasts. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they'd be like, I don't know anything about stone structures. I'm here to stay in the inn here.
I'm pretty sure, you could do, like, a ghost tour in Dublin. We didn't. The one ghost thing that we did, which is something that I'm going to remember for the rest of my life, and if anybody is anywhere near this place, they really, really should go. But in the Brimstone Deceit, I wrote about a spot called Lip Castle. L-E-A-P, Lip Castle. And it was a, it's known as one of the more haunted castles in Ireland. There was a series of seances in the 19th century where a Miss Darby accidentally conjured up something that is known as the elemental, which is like this short little shaggy creature that smells like a corpse that like is covered in like gray wool and has like a skeleton face. That's after the history of the castle, you know, that just has nothing to do with that. I mean, so this place built probably in the 13th century. And we're getting there.
But I didn't have time to go. And I'm like, what?
We definitely went there. Built in the 13th century, it's known for having an oubliette, a haunted oubliette. Do you know what an oubliette is, Tim?
I do not know what an oubliette is.
Well, when a man and a woman love each other very much, they sometimes build a dungeon that is only accessible through a hole in the roof. And that's what
through a hole. Wait a minute, a dungeon on the roof?
No, it's a dungeon. I should have said ceiling. It's a dungeon that is only accessible through a hole in the ceiling.
So is it above the bedroom or is it below?
Well, it depends on where you are. In Ireland, so originally the term is French, meaning it's derived from a word that means to forget. In Ireland,
I'm going to get salacious, but is it like a sex dungeon, or is it just a place where people would have sex, like, because it was so weirdly, you know, where it's just like so weird, where like they couldn't show a married couple sleeping in the same bed on TV, like in the 60s kind of thing, where it's like, if we're going to make love, we have to go into the sex dungeon, or the oubliette, because then God can't see us there, some shit like that.
Anywhere is a sex dungeon if you and your partner believe in yourself enough, Tim.
I know you were sitting on that joke for a while.
I was joking. There's nothing sexy about an oubliette. It's purely a dungeon. And in this case, it was actually lined with like sharp shards of metal. So this place has an oubliette, which is creepy to begin with. In this case, I was mentioning in France, they tend to do them more below ground, but all the oubliettes that I saw on this trip were above ground because of the rocky soil in Ireland. But there's not only an oubliette, but there's also a space adjacent to the oubliette called the Bloody Chapel, right? Because of some other sightings that have happened there. So the castle has a very very dark history. And I looked it up, and we found directions to go to it. And there's no signage. Like everywhere you go in Ireland, there are. Whenever you have a castle, there's signage for it. It's a tourist destination.
Right.
And there's no signage for it. But eventually, like I see a castle in the distance, about a kilometer away. And I'm like, well, here's the castle. It looks like about right. There's a little sign out front that says Lip Castle and doesn't say anything about. There's no tourist parking. There's just a wall and a little sign that says Lip Castle. So we park across from the castle. By the way, driving in Ireland, I would drive in Ireland any day over driving in Atlanta. Like everybody's.
Well, how was the well? Yeah, we haven't even gotten into like the everyday aspect of being in another country, but we'll get to that in a moment. So,
okay, sorry.
Because I'm interested by that. You drove on the wrong side of the opposite side, right? I assume.
Yeah, and it's not that like I mean the roads are narrower, so like when no matter who is sitting in the no matter who's driving or who's sitting in the passenger seat, it's a harrowing experience because like you always feel like you're like 3 inches from this giant stone wall on your left, but everybody seems to be very patient in terms of like stopping and letting people go by. And like there wasn't this sort of thing in America where you're like, if I break traffic rules, I'm going to get a $200 fine. Like there's none of that. We saw two cops the entire time. And like the traffic laws are very much situationally based. So like, if you need to drive on the wrong side of the road to get around somebody, you know, they'll do that. That's fine. Nobody cares. So anyway, so we parked again, and you know, we were sort of on the road, but we're like, you know, it's Ireland. People are going to, you know, find a way around our car. It's no big deal. And we walk down this path past the outside wall of the castle, and it says there's a gatehouse, and on the door of the gatehouse it says, "For castle inquiries, go ring doorbell." So we continued down, you know, I don't know, probably another 100 feet down this driveway. And outside is this guy who looks like, you know, a really nice guy. So if for some reason he's listening, don't take this the wrong way, but he looks kind of like Santa Claus with hepatitis, you know?
Jesus.
He's got a big bushy beard, and he looks a little sickly. And he's feeding his cat.
Oddly
outside.
Specific, but yeah. He's feeding cats?
He's feeding cats outside. And I said, you know, is the castle open to the public? And he goes, yeah. Come in. And the guy owns the castle. He bought it back in the 90s, and he owns this place. And
yeah, you can buy castles.
He'll let people just come in. The floors were bombed out, and it's a war, but he lets people come in and take a look at his home, basically. So we sit down. We sit down by the fire with him. So I'm sitting in a castle, my wife, the castle owner, and myself. We're sitting in front of a fireplace and just talking with this guy. We talk for a little while. He picks up his penny whistle and starts playing a tune on his penny whistle for us. And it's all very casual and all very surreal, like, because it's such an intimate thing. And it seems like it's so, like, you're not going to see a tourist bus outside of this place. Because, I mean, like, I'm sure the guy isn't insured for any of the things, you know. There are some spots on the way up the tower, which I'll get to in a moment, where I'm sure that if I had put my mind to it, I could have hurt myself very badly. And I'm sure the guy's not insured for it at all. But it's very much like, you know, just opening up his house because he's aware of the history. So we're in this wonderful intimate moment. I made reference to the fact that I was aware of some of the history of the house, and he was pretty cagey about it. My sort of, you know, my Fortean mantra is, I will let you know that I'm interested in these things and I will mention them, but I'm not going to, like, badger you about it, you know? So he didn't seem very forthcoming about some stuff that had happened, but, you know, when I also said, you know, I'm familiar with, you know, Miss Darby and the Oubliette and whatnot, he didn't really say anything about that, but he said, he said when I bought the place, it was a really interesting day when they cleaned out the Oubliette. He said it took them 3 truckloads to get all the bones out.
Jesus Christ, really? When did he buy the place?
And the guy sleeps there. Like, that's
he got the... So essentially, the bones at least were there, like, I don't know, since the 60s, till the 60s or whatever.
Yeah.
Like,
so
they never cleaned out the bones?
It was a ruin. Nobody wanted to do anything about it. And he bought it, probably for a song. And he spent the last, like, 1990, so he spent, like, the last, you know, 25, 30
years.
How old are we? Yeah, 30 years. God, can you believe that?
We're old.
It's been the last 30 years refurbishing it. Says he has a wife. His daughter just left, I presume, for college.
I like how you phrase that. Says he has a wife. Says he has a wife. She could have been chained in the Oubliette. I don't know.
Yeah. So it's not like, you know, he lives there, but I'm sure that, like, we read online later that people call him up and neighbors will call him and be like, yeah, the monk is on your roof again. Or, like, you know, we're seeing lights coming from the bloody chapel. I just wanted you to know that, you know.
How weird.
And so you give him €6 and you can basically look in his bedroom and go on up the tower and take a look in the bloody chapel, take a look down at the Oubliette, which supposedly has a spirit that haunts it. No, it didn't say anything. Of course, again, this was like, you know, this was like 11 a.m. or something. So
Right.
No, exactly.
Now, here's something crazy. I don't know if I would do this, but maybe I would if I was over there. But could you, like, be like, here's €100, dude. I want to sleep in the Oubliette tonight. You think he'd be down for that?
I can't imagine that, like, I mean, I don't know, man. I can't imagine that he wouldn't be down for that. I mean, it's so, like, there are only a couple of rooms. Well, there are only a couple of rooms in the place that are finished.
Look, whether or not Anton is indeed a midget or a dwarf...
No, he's a midget.
What's the difference?
Well, a dwarf is someone who has disproportionately short arms and legs.
Oh, I know the ones.
Yeah, it's caused by a hormone deficiency.
Yeah, bloody hormones. Yeah.
Mm. A midget is still a dwarf, but their arms and legs are in proportion.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
So, what's an elf?
Do you want to answer that?
An elf is a supernatural being. Sometimes they're invisible, they're like fairies.
They don't actually exist, do they? In real life?